This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Eli Wallach is such a versatile actor. He's famous for his interpretation of Tennessee Williams and for his starring roles in Westerns. Williams gave Wallach one of his first big breaks, casting him in The Rose Tattoo. Wallach made his film debut in Baby Doll, which was also written by Williams. In 1960, Wallach was the heavy in The Magnificent Seven. He later played another heavy in a film of heavies, The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly. His other movies include The Misfits, The Lineup, The Victors, Girlfriends, and Movie Movie. Over the summer, he appeared in The Two Jakes, and next month you can see him in Godfather III. Throughout his career, he's divided his time between stage and screen. He's currently touring with his wife, the actress Anne Jackson, in a production of A.R. Gurney's play Love Letters. This week they perform at Philadelphia's Schubert Theater. Wallach was a charter member of the Actors Studio, where the actors practiced a technique that became known as the method.
All of it basically was an antidote from the cliché, from the conventional. You know, when an actor says, "I remember," and he always looks up the sky, you think, what is he seeing up there? But that was a signal that he's remembering. And the method basically was to destroy all that and to get to the truth of a situation. So the studio was like a laboratory. We were professional actors in the theater, but we could go there and work out. I could go and do a scene from Hamlet with Millie Dunnick, for example. I'd do the closet scene. I wouldn't get to do that on Broadway. And I did it there.
Let's go back to the cliched way of "I remember when," and the actor looks at the sky. If you had a scene where you were remembering something, what would you do differently to get into it?
Well, I would actually try to remember. Although I know the next line. It says, it was that time of... Have you ever forgotten something and the person says... It's like having water in your ear. You go to sleep and it'll come out, the water will come out of your ear later. And you've heard people say, 10 minutes after they've tried to think of something, "Oh," and then they'll say, "Palm Beach." That's what I look for, the true situation, not the cliché.
Yet there were clichés about actors who'd studied the method at the Actors Studio, right? What was the cliché that you had to resist about actors from the Actors Studio?
Well, there's a myth that all members of the studio mumbled. All members of the studio paid no attention to the other person. They were so involved in dredging up the truth of what they had that they paid no attention to the other person. Those are myths. We were impossible. We discovered a new religion, and we had no patience for other actors. I never forget taking Sir Laurence Olivier to the Actors Studio, and he said, "Well, I can see you're nitpicking now, you know." And I said, "Well, you did it too. You have your way of working." Olivier, for example, gets into a character by putting on the externals. He puts on the nose and the robe and so on, and that's the way he gets it. Others say, which comes first? Do you find the truth of the situation? I've played all sorts of characters, bandits. I've played a lot of bandits. And one time I figured out, you always see them holding up the train or breaking into the bank. You never see what they do with the money. It's always the pursuit of it. I wanted to show the reverse side of the coin. I wanted to show the wealth this guy ostentatiously had. So I put on red silk shirts and gold teeth and silver saddles. And that's where the method helps, a kind of a technique that you work at to bring a character to life.
Was that The Magnificent Seven?
That was The Magnificent Seven, yeah.
My guess is Eli Wallach, since you've brought up how many bandits you've played, let me bring up a couple of films you've played them in. One was The Magnificent Seven, and you played the head of a band of Mexican outlaws,
right,
who raids a village and keeps this village under the outlaws' control. And The Magnificent Seven is a group of kind of renegade freelance fighters who save this Mexican village. How'd you get cast in that role?
First of all, you were
Mexican.
I don't really know. I know that when I first read the script, I said, "Well, I want to play the crazy." It was based on the Seven Samurai.
Mm-hmm.
"I want to play the crazy samurai." "Oh no," they said, "that's the love interest. Horst Buchholz is going to play it." "What do you want me to play?" They said, "the head bandit." I said, "Well, in the Japanese movie, you just see his horse's hoofs, and he's a man with an eye patch. I don't want to play that." Then I read the script carefully, and I come in right into town in the first minute of that movie, shoot somebody, and ride out. The next 50 minutes of that movie are devoted to me saying, is he coming back? When is he coming? I said, I'll do it. I'll do it. And I used to arrive on the set early in the morning, put on my outfit, get on my horse with my 35 bandits, and we'd go for an hour ride through the brush in Tepoztlan in Mexico. And I loved it. I loved it.
Did you have to learn gunplay and horse riding for the role?
No. If it says I shoot somebody, I shoot them. I'll never forget what my son said. Yul Brynner shot and killed me in this movie. And my son was about 7, and he said to me, gee, Dad, couldn't you outdraw Yul Brynner? I said, Peter, when you read the script, you read whether you're shot or not shot. So I love those kind of films. They're fun.
Now, another famous Western that you did is The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly.
Right.
Now, this is the most celebrated of the spaghetti Westerns.
Correct.
And the director, Sergio Leone, is now considered one of the great directors of our time. He was not known, though, when you worked with him on The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly. Did you think of him as a great or potentially great director then?
No, when I was making a film in California, when the agent out there said, there's an Italian here who wants you to be in a movie. I said, what kind of movie? He said, a Western. He said, a spaghetti Western. I said, that's an anomaly. That's like Hawaiian pizza. I don't know. He said, he wants you to look at a few minutes of one of his other movies. And I looked at a few minutes and I said, I'll do it. Where do you want me to go? He said, I want you in Rome on such and such a date. And I arrived and I spent the next 4.5 months working every day on that movie. And it was an exhilarating experience.
Well, now, what had he seen of yours?
Evidently, The Magnificent Seven. So then, I don't know how, you never know how things happen in the movies.
Did it seem ironic to you that you and Clint Eastwood, who had played in American Westerns, were now making a Western for an Italian director?
Originally, all those Italians changed their names. Two of the biggest stars in Italy are Terence Hill and Bud Spencer. Their real names are Mario Girotti and Carlo Pedersoli. And they changed their names because no one wanted to go and see Italians playing Westerns. But I, after The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly, I spent about 6 years off and on in Italy doing Westerns.
You played a Mexican in The Good, Bad, and the Ugly.
Yep.
So once again, you had to do a Mexican accent. But it was a light one. It was kind of light,
yes.
Mexican accent. I want to play a short clip from the movie.
Oh.
Okay. And this is a scene. If anyone remembers the story, I'm sure a lot of our listeners do, you and Clint Eastwood have this scam going. There's a big price on your head.
Right.
So Clint Eastwood brings you into the law. And just as they're about to hang you, he cuts you loose and you both ride away and you split the bounty.
Exactly.
So you split the price that was on your head. So this is after the first time when you're about to be hung, Clint Eastwood frees you and you're splitting up the bounty.
Right.
There are two kinds of people in the world, my friend. Those with a rope around their neck and the people who have the job of doing the cutting. Listen, the neck at the end of the rope is mine. I run the risks. So the next time I want more than half.
You may run the risks, my friend, but I do the cutting. We cut down my percentage. Cigar? Liable to interfere with my aim.
But if you miss, you had better miss very well. Whoever double-crosses me and leaves me alive, he understands nothing about Tuco. Nothing.
I love that little sadistic laugh at the end.
But I don't think it's a very good Mexican accent. It's standardized. It isn't. I didn't do the cliche of I think maybe I do la third. You know, I don't. I didn't do that. I wanted specifically to be clear in what I was saying.
So where did you get the accent from?
I went to school in Texas as a young man. I went to the University of Texas in the 30s. In my class were John Connolly, Walter Cronkite, Zachary Scott, and Elaine Steinbeck. And I used to ride horses down there, and I used to go to Mexico as often as I could. I loved Mexico. I think Mexico is a pure country. It's a good country. And so I picked up. Accents always frighten me, but I once played an Oriental on the stage in London Tea House of the August Moon. And I was convinced that at some point in the play, some Japanese man would stand up in the audience and point at me and say, "Faker, that man is not an Oriental." See? And I get terrified that I'd get discovered.
In the Italian westerns that you made, especially in The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly, everything's dubbed, right?
Right.
Afterwards?
Right.
So what language did you do it in initially?
Oh, I do it in English.
You do it in English.
And I've played with Italians, French, German. They play in their language. I play in mine.
So in these international casts, everybody's talking in their own language.
Exactly.
And it's dubbed in afterwards.
It's the Tower of Babel. It really is. But you wait until they stop speaking, or you know what the sense of what they're saying. But then you have to go in a studio and dub it. And I kept thinking of scenes on horseback riding through the desert. Now I am in a studio. I have to match the essence of what he's saying. It's not easy.
Why do they do it that way?
Because it's easier and cheaper. An airplane flies over, they don't stop a scene. They drop a wrench in the middle of a scene. It makes a noise. They don't care. Two other Italians over in a corner will be arguing about something. One director said to an Italian actor who's playing with me, he said to me, the Italian actor said, "I don't like Americans." I said, "Why?" He said, "I lost my arm in the war." I said, "Well, I don't know. What could I do?" He was not an actor. So the director said, "I want you to count from 1 to 10 angrily." So the man said, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. And then when they dub it in, he's playing a wonderful scene, an angry actor. Well, that's movies.
The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly is really one of the most kind of brutal, sadistic westerns.
No, it's done with tongue in cheek.
I know. It is. I know there's a lot of humor in it. But what kind of mood did Leone, or Leone, I'm never sure which it is,
Leone,
tell you that he wanted?
One of the things he said to me, he said, "I want every shot to be done like Vermeer. I want the light to come in from the side windows." And he said to me, "I don't want you to have your gun in a holster." I said, "Where will I put it?" He said, "With a lanyard around your neck." I said, "Oh, and then it dangles between my knees, right?" He said, "Yeah." He said, "When you want it, you twist your shoulders and I cut and the gun is in your hand." I said, "Show me." He put it around his neck. He twisted his shoulder. He missed the gun. It hit him in the groin. He said, "Keep it in your pocket." So that's
It's interesting that you became a kind of action hero when you were probably in your 50s already.
When The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly?
And The Magnificent Seven.
Yeah.
You must have been in your 40s in The Magnificent Seven. But, you know, like today, most action heroes are a lot younger. It's like they start off in their 20s and 30s playing that kind of role. Yeah. Did you feel like it was an odd match?
Well, you wear very tight pants in these movies, and to get up on a horse, they'd always have to cut. I'd put my foot in the stirrup, but then they'd cut away to somebody looking at me, and the next thing I was on the horse. See? So, no, I tell you, in The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly, I did most of the stunts, and they were very dangerous. I was sitting on a horse with a noose around my neck, and Clint's supposed to shoot the rope. Then they put a little charge of dynamite in the rope, and it would explode. And then I would ride off on this horse. I said, "Did you put any cotton in the horse's ears?" They said, "What do you mean, cotton in the horse's ears?" I said, "He can hear the explosion. He's going to be terrified. My hands are tied behind me." Well, they didn't do it. They shot the rope, and that horse took off. Now I'm riding, not using reins, just using my knees, and praying that that horse would eventually stop. And eventually he did. But it was frightening.
Oh, I'm really impressed because, I mean, that horse really takes off
after
the gun goes off.
Oh, yeah.
And I assumed there was some kind of trick there or something because I figured it would really need a stunt rider to ride that with their hands tied behind their back.
No, I rode, but you have to be very careful. Horses are not, you know, I just came from Lexington, Kentucky in the horse country. We did the play down there. And horses are not supposed to be too smart. Thoroughbreds are very frisky. They're angry most of the time.
Yeah.
The horses I get in America, in American films, are trained. They know how to hit their marks. They shift their weight. They look great. But when you get into a foreign movie and they bring out a horse, I say, "I want the gentlest, sweetest horse. And he usually turns around and looks at me when I sit on him and thinks, oh, God, I've got this guy for 3 weeks. But I like riding.
I want to get back to something you were saying before. You were describing how you learned how to ride a horse and how you learned a Mexican accent when you were at the University of Texas. I can't think of a lot of people from Brooklyn who went to Texas to go to college, and this must have been, what, the 1940s?
In the 30s.
In the 30s. What got you to Texas to go to college?
The tuition was $30 a year. The University of Texas was an oil-rich college, university. It's a huge plant now with 40, 50,000 students. When I went, it was 4,000 students. And I couldn't get into City College. I didn't have the grades. I never liked high school. And I finally wound up down in Texas. I'll never forget, after the first semester, I went back up to New York to make some money for my tuition. And I wore a big belt that said Tex, Texas on it. And they used to call me Tex. Here I was from Brooklyn. And so they assigned me as a horseback riding counselor. And so I had to ride. And that's one of the reasons I rode a lot.
When did you start acting?
As a boy, as a little boy. And then before the war, I went into the neighborhood playhouse. I failed the teacher's exam. Everybody in my family were teachers. Thank God I failed it. And I went, got a scholarship to the neighborhood playhouse school of the theater. I'm on the board of that school now. It's a wonderful acting school. I finished, one of the teachers was Martha Graham, Sanford Meisner, and so on. I finished in 1940, and we did our senior project was a dance from Look Home with Angel. Tony Randall was in the class. We choreographed Look Home with Angel. And at one point, Uncle Sam stands on a thing and points a finger at me and says, Uncle Sam wants you. And sure enough, I got a low number in the draft, and Uncle Sam got me. So I went in the Army at the end of 1940 and got out at the end of 1945. So I spent 5 full years in the Army, not acting. I kept thinking, Broadway, here I come. And Uncle Sam kept saying, wait a minute, we've got problems here. So I spent 5 years as a medical administrator in the Army.
Eli Wallach is my guest. We'll be seeing you soon in Godfather 3. I haven't been keeping up with all the articles about it. What kind of role do you play in it?
I play a character called Don Altobello.
You're Italian again.
Yes, tall and handsome. Don Altobello, an old, old friend of the Corleone family. So I said to Coppola, the director, if I'm such an old, old friend of the family, why wasn't I in Godfather 1 and Godfather 2? He says, well, you were away in Sicily. And it was very sweet. The second day I was going to work on this movie, he said to me, you're going to play it all in Sicilian. I said, no, I don't know Sicilian. He said, well, get a guy, you get a cassette, you'll memorize it. So I memorized it, and there'll be subtitles under that scene, that specific scene. I play, it sounds like this. E che bello vita stare qua. Like that.
Had you seen The Godfathers 1 and 2?
Oh, yes.
So you felt you could just pick up on the story?
Well, no. When I got the script, the last 10 pages were omitted.
Why?
Because he didn't want anybody to know their fate in this movie.
Oh, like Woody Allen.
Oh, you had no idea where I was going. I didn't know what was going to happen to me. And it's very interesting not to know. It's like life. You don't know when you're going to pop off, right? And he was a fascinating director because he would stimulate. He'd tighten a screw here and tighten a screw there with just a word or two. And he'd leave me alone pretty much. I played an old man with an hour and 20 minutes of these rubberized makeup thing on. Now, to go from Cinecittà in Rome back to my hotel at the Spanish Steps would take an hour by car. So I rode the subway. So the first day I finished, I got on the subway, which was 20 minutes, very fast. And I'm sitting there looking at my script, and I'm peeling off all this rubberized makeup. And I look up, and there, the opposite side of the car of the subway, they're all staring at me. Half my chin was off with this rubberized. And I put it back on, and they applauded. That's Italy.
Did they realize you were an actor? Did they think something very grotesque was happening?
They knew I was coming from Cinecittà, so they know all the actors come out of that studio.
Oh, I see. You're currently in Philadelphia performing in A.R. Gurney's play, Love Letters, and you're performing with your wife, Ann Jackson. I know this is a play that you're very fond of. Tell us something about it.
Well, what's fascinating about this is every actor in America wants to do this play. And it's being done by a great number of actors. E.G. Marshall is doing it with Colleen Dewhurst. Matthew Broderick is doing it with some young actress. In England, it's being done by Robert Wagner and Stephanie Powers. It's being done all over the United States and all over the world. It's two people sitting there reading letters to one another from about age 6 to their late 50s. And an audience becomes hooked into this correspondence and what happens to these two people. And they all identify with it. They remember their first kiss, their first date, going dancing, your first affair. All of that is taken in, and it's just wonderful. It's wonderful to hear an audience respond to that.
Have you been able to work with your wife, Ann Jackson, much in theater? And how do these opportunities present themselves?
I think it saved the marriage, and it saved psychiatry bills and marriage counselors, because we tend to get plays to do which have great fights in them, and we air out all our grievances theatrically. She and I have been acting together over 40 years now, and I enjoy it. I enjoy acting with her. So we're going to do a new play in New Jersey in this next year.
So how does fighting on stage prevent you from fighting at home?
Oh, no, we do fight at home, uh-huh. But it's in the middle of a fight, I think, oh, God, my voice is open, it's clear.
This is good. Yeah.
Yeah, it's good. And then I always try to think of her side of the situation. One thing actors have to do is really listen to the other person. In a fight, your emotions tend to cloud up all the listening process. Well, as an actor, I always try to listen to what she's saying, to try to get through to what her complaint is. And I think that helps.
You've, throughout your career, divided your time between theater and movies. Have you had a preference? What kind of balance have you wanted to keep?
Well, I've got the appetite still to act. I love to act. And I don't care where it is. It could be in a tiny theater in Chicago, or it can be on a huge stage in New York, or a movie in the middle of the jungle in Cambodia. The fact is that I'm acting in each one of those media, in the media. But if given a choice, if I were told by a judge, you can only practice one of television, movies, or the theater, I'd choose the theater without hesitation.
Why?
Because the gratification is immediate. There's a connection between me and an audience. I have control over what you see. In a movie, you only see what's put on the screen. I did that movie, The Two Jakes, with Jack Nicholson. When they cut it and edited it, I had a long scene in a courtroom that was cut out. Now no one knows about that. In The Good, the Bad, the Ugly, there's 20 minutes of me tracking down Clint Eastwood in a cave. It's beautiful, brilliantly shot. No one has ever seen it. So I don't like that. I like to have control over what you see.
I want to thank you so much for talking with us.
A pleasure.
My guest has been Eli Wallach, and he'll be in Godfather 3, which is scheduled to open next month. And now he's performing the A.R. Gurney play Love Letters in Philadelphia with his wife, the actress Ann Jackson. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.